Chapter 3. Le chapeau et trois cornes farcaille le Robespierre. Le tire bas de l'odalisque. Six entrées. Sauté de Antons et le Pinglière. Cotillettes et le Megatherium. Burst de Vaux et le Pelsambleu. Latences de Carpe, Engaguet et le Rhine Palmer. Turban de Valais et l'Archevic de Canterbury. And so on with the entremets, and hors d'oeuvres, and the rodus, and the relieves. Madame will see that the dinners are quite simple, said M. Cavalcader. Oh, quite, said Rosa, dreadfully puzzled. Which would Madame like? Which would we like, Mama? Rosa asked, adding, as if after a little thought, I think, sir, we should prefer the blue one. At which Mrs. Gashley nodded as knowingly as she could. Though pink or blue, I defy anybody to know what these cooks mean by their jargon. If you please, madam, we will go down below and examine the scene of operations, Monsieur Cavalcader said. And so he was marshaled down the stairs to the kitchen, which he didn't like to name, and appeared before the cook in all his splendor. He cast a rapid glance round the premises, and a smile of something like contempt lighted up his features. Will you bring pen and ink, if you please, and I will write down a few of the articles which will be necessary for us? We shall require, if you please, 8 more stew pans, a couple of braising pans, 8 sauté pans, 6 bain marie pans, a freezing pot with accessories, and a few more articles of which I will inscribe the names. And Mr. Cavalcader did so, dashing down, with the rapidity of genius, a tremendous list of ironmongery goods, which he handed over to Mrs. Timmons. She and her mama were quite frightened by the awful catalogue. I will call 3 days hence, and superintend the progress of matters, and we will make the stock for the soup the day before the dinner. Don't you think, sir, here interposed Mrs. Gashley, that one soup a fine rich mock turtle, such as I have seen in the best houses in the west of England, and such as the late Lord Fortescue, you will get what is wanted for the soups, if you please, Mr. Cavalcader continued, not heeding this interruption, and as bold as a captain on his own quarter deck colon for the stock of clear soup, you will get a leg of beef, a leg of veal, and a ham. Oui, monsieur, said the cook, dropping a terrified curtsy colon a leg of beef, a leg of veal, and a ham. You can't serve a leg of veal at a party, said Mrs. Gashley, and a leg of beef is not a company dish. Madam, they are to make the stock of the clear soup, Mr. Cavalcader said. What? Cried Mrs. Gashley, and the cook repeated his former expression. Never, whilst I am in this house, cried out Mrs. Gashley, indignantly, never in a Christian English household, never shall such sinful waste be permitted by me. If you wish me to dine, Rosa, you must get a dinner less expensive. The Right Honorable Lord Fortescue could dine, sir, without these wicked luxuries, and I presume my daughter's guests can. Madam is perfectly at liberty to decide, said M. Cavalcader. I came to oblige Madame and my good friend Mirabilin, not myself. Thank you, sir, I think it will be too expensive, Rosa stammered in a great flutter, but I am very much obliged to you. Il n'y a point d'obligation, Madame, said Monsieur Alcide Camille Cavalcader in his most superb manner, and, making a splendid bow to the lady of the house, was respectfully conducted to the upper regions by Little Buttons, leaving Rosa frightened, the cook amazed and silent, and Mrs. Gashley boiling with indignation against the dresser. Up to that moment, Mrs. Bloser, the cook, who had come out of Devonshire with Mrs. Gashley, of course, that lady garrisoned her daughter's house with servants, and expected them to give her information of everything which took place there, up to that moment, I say, the cook had been quite contented with that subterraneous station which she occupied in life, and had a pride in keeping her kitchen neat, bright, and clean. It was, in her opinion, the comfortablest room in the house. We all thought so, when we came down of a night to smoke there, and the handsomest kitchen in Lilliput Street. But after the visit of Cavalcador, the cook became quite discontented and uneasy in her mind. She talked in a melancholy manner over the area railings to the cooks at 23 and 25. She stepped over the way and conferred with the cook there. She made inquiries at the baker's and at other places about the kitchens in the great houses in Brobdingnag Gardens and how many spits, bangmuri pans, and stew pans they had. She thought she could not do with an occasional help, but must have a kitchen maid. And she was often discovered by a gentleman of the police force, who was, I believe, her cousin, and occasionally visited her when Mrs. Gashley was not in the house or spying it. She was discovered seated with Mrs. Rundle in her lap, its leaves bespattered with her tears. "Why, peace be gone, Pellis," she said, "since I saw that Sir Frenchman." And it was all the faithful fellow could do to console her. "The dinner," said Timmons, in a rage at last. "Having it cooked in the house is out of the question. The bother of it, and the row your mother makes, are enough to drive one mad. It won't happen again, I can promise you, Rosa. Order it at Fubsby's, at once. You can have everything from Fubsby's, from footman to salt spoons. Let's go and order it at Fubsby's. Darling, if you don't mind the expense, and it will be any relief to you, let us do as you wish," Rosa said. And she put on her bonnet, and they went off to the grand cook and confectioner of the Brobdingnag Quarter. On the arm of her Fitzroy, Rosa went off to Fubsby's, that magnificent shop at the corner of Parliament Plus and Alicompane Square, a shop into which the rogue had often cast a glance of approbation as he passed. For there are not only the most wonderful and delicious cakes and confections in the window, but at the counter there are almost sure to be three or four of the prettiest women in the whole of this world, with little darling caps of the last French make, with beautiful wavy hair, and the neatest possible waists and aprons. Yes, there they sit. And others, perhaps, besides Fitz have cast a sheep's eye through those enormous plate glass window panes. I suppose it is the fact of perpetually living among such a quantity of good things that makes those young ladies so beautiful. They come into the place, let us say, like ordinary people, and gradually grow handsomer and handsomer, until they grow out into the perfect angels you see. It can't be otherwise. If you and I, my dear fellow, were to have a course of that place, we should become beautiful too. They live in an atmosphere of the most delicious pineapples, blancmanges, creams, some whipped, and some so good, that of course they don't want whipping. Jellies, tipsy cakes, cherry brandy, 100,000 sweet and lovely things. Look at the preserved fruits, look at the golden ginger, the outspreading ananas, the darling little rogues of China oranges, ranged in the gleaming crystal cylinders. Mon Dieu! Look at the strawberries in the leaves. Each of them is as large nearly as a lady's reticule, and looks as if it had been brought up in the nursery to itself. One of those strawberries is a meal for those young ladies, behind the counter. They nibble off a little from the side, and if they are very hungry, which can scarcely ever happen, they are allowed to go to the crystal canisters and take out a rout cake or macaroon. In the evening they sit and tell each other little riddles out of the bonbons, and when they wish to amuse themselves, they read the most delightful remarks, in the French language, about love, and Cupid, and beauty, before they place them inside the crackers. They always are writing down good things into Mr. Fubsby's ledgers. It must be a perfect feast to read them. Talk of the Garden of Eden. I believe it was nothing to Mr. Fubsby's house. And I have no doubt that after those young ladies have been there a certain time, they get to such a pitch of loveliness at last, that they become complete angels, with wings sprouting out of their lovely shoulders, when, after giving just a preparatory balance or two, they fly up to the counter, and perch there for a minute, hop down again, and affectionately kiss the other young ladies, and say, "Goodbye, dears. We shall meet again, la haut." And then with a whir of their deliciously scented wings, away they fly for good, whisking over the trees of Brobdingnag Square, and up into the sky, as the policeman touches his hat. It is up there that they invent the legends for the crackers, and the wonderful riddles and remarks on the bonbons. No mortal, I am sure, could write them. I never saw a man in such a state as Fitzroy Timmons in the presence of those ravishing hours. Mrs. Fitz having explained that they required a dinner for 20 persons, the chief young lady asked what Mr. and Mrs. Fitz would like, and named a thousand things, each better than the other, to all of which Fitz instantly said yes. The wretch was in such a state of infatuation that I believe, if that lady had proposed to him a fricasseed elephant, or a boa constrictor in jelly, he would have said, "Oh yes, certainly, put it down." That Purai wrote down in her album a list of things which it would make your mouth water to listen to. But she took it all quite calmly. Heaven bless you. They don't care about things that are no delicacies to them. But whatever she chose to write down, Fitzroy let her. After the dinner and dessert were ordered at Fubsby's, they furnish everything. Dinner and dessert, plate and china, servants in your own livery, and, if you please, guests of title too. The married couple retreated from that shop of wonders, Rosa delighted that the trouble of the dinner was all off their hands, but she was afraid it would be rather expensive. "Nothing can be too expensive which pleases you, dear," Fitz said. "By the way, one of those young women was rather good-looking," Rosa remarked, "Colin, the one in the cap with the blue ribbons." And she cast about the shape of the cap in her mind, and determined to have exactly such another. "Think so? I didn't observe," said the miserable hypocrite by her side. And when he had seen Rosa home, he went back, like an infamous fiend, to order something else which he had forgotten. He said, "At Fubsby's. Get out of that paradise, you cowardly, creeping, vile serpent, you." Until the day of the dinner, the infatuated fop was always going to Fubsby's. He was remarked there. He used to go, before he went to chambers in the morning, and sometimes on his return from the temple. But the morning was the time which he preferred. And one day, when he went on one of his eternal pretexts, and was chattering and flirting at the counter, a lady who had been reading yesterday's paper, and eating a halfpenny bun for an hour in the back shop, if that paradise may be called a shop, a lady stepped forward, laid down the Morning Herald, and confronted him. That lady was Mrs. Gashley. From that day the miserable Fitzroy was in her power, and she resumed a sway over his house, to shake off which had been the object of his life, and the result of many battles. And for a mere freak, for, on going into Fubsby's a week afterwards, he found the Paris drinking tea out of blue cups, and eating stale bread and butter, when his absurd passion instantly vanished. I say, for a mere freak, the most intolerable burden of his life was put on his shoulders again his mother-in-law. On the day before the little dinner took place, and I promise you we shall come to it in the very next chapter, a tall and elegant middle-aged gentleman, who might have passed for an earl, but that there was a slight incompleteness about his hands and feet, the former being uncommonly red, and the latter large and irregular, was introduced to Mrs. Timmons by the page, who announced him as Mr. Truncheon. "I'm Truncheon, ma'am," he said, with a low bow. "Indeed," said Rosa. "About the dinner M'M, from Fubsby's, M'M. As you have no butler, M'M, I presume you will wish me to act as such. I shall bring two persons as aides tomorrow, both answers to the name of John. I'd best, if you please, inspect the premises, and will thank you to allow your young man to show me the pantry and kitchen." Truncheon spoke in a low voice, and with the deepest and most respectful melancholy. There is not much expression in his eyes, but from what there is, you would fancy that he was oppressed by a secret sorrow. Rosa trembled as she surveyed this gentleman's size, his splendid appearance, and gravity. "I'm sure," she said, "I never shall dare to ask him to hand a glass of water. Even Mrs. Gashley, when she came on the morning of the actual dinner party to superintend matters, was cowed and retreated from the kitchen before the calm majesty of truncheon. And yet that great man was, like all the truly great, affable. He put aside his coat and waistcoat, both of evening cut, and looking prematurely splendid as he walked the streets in noonday, and did not disdain to rub the glasses and polish the decanters, and to show young Buttons the proper mode of preparing these articles for a dinner. And while he operated, the maids, and Buttons, and cook, when she could, and what had she but the vegetables to boil, crowded round him, and listened with wonder as he talked of the great families as he had lived with. That man, as they saw him there before them, had been cab boy to Lord Tantillon, valet to the Earl of Barrisers, and groom of the chambers to the Duchess Dowager of Fitzbattleaxe. Oh, it was delightful to hear Mr. Truncheon vie on the great, momentous, stupendous day of the dinner. My beloved female reader may imagine that Fitzroy Timmons was sent about his business at an early hour in the morning, while the women began to make preparations to receive their guests. Here will be no need of your going to Fubsby's, Mrs. Gashley said to him, with a look that drove him out of doors. The very thing that we require has been ordered there. You will please to be back here at 6 o'clock, and not sooner. And I presume you will acquiesce in my arrangements about the wine? Oh yes, Mama, said the prostrate son-in-law. In so large a party beyond some folks means expensive. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.